You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, June 20th, 2011. And today on Write the Book, you're going to hear an interview with Vermont writer Laban Carrick-Hill, who is the author of over 30 books, including his latest, which is the historical picture book and poem, Dave the Potter. Laban Carrick-Hill is the co-director, along with physicist and writer Martin Egblewogbe, and I'm sorry if I'm not saying that right, of the Writers Project of Ghana, a nonprofit based in Ghana and the U.S. Founded in 2009, the WPG promotes literary culture and literacy through creative writing workshops, readings, discussion groups, a reference library of world and African literature, and a small press. He is a core faculty member of the Solstice MFA in Creative Writing Low Residency Program at Pine Manor College in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Laban Carrick-Hill's newest book, Dave the Potter, Artist, Slave, Poet, is a picture book, poem illustrated by Brian Collier and appearing in September. It appeared in September 2010 with Little Brown Books for Young Readers. Laban's award-winning America Dreaming, How Youth Changed America in the 60s, also with Little Brown, won the 2007 Parenting Publications Gold Award. The New York Times Book Review wrote, excellent. Howard Zinn praised the cultural history as a phenomenal piece of work, extensively researched and visually stimulating, an essential resource for children and adults of all ages. America Dreaming examines the legacy of the 60s and how the events that took place then inform our lives today. Laban Carrick-Hill is the author of more than 25 books, including the 2000, actually more than 35 at this point, including the 2004 National Book Award finalist Harlem Stomp, A Cultural History of the Harlem Renaissance, a book he researched for more than a decade. He was drawn to this era because the Harlem Renaissance seemed to embody Ralph Ellison's sense that America could not be America without African Americans. Hill has also taught writing at Columbia University, Baruch College, and St. Michael's College in Vermont. He's currently teaching at Pine Manor College Solstice MFA in Writing Program, as I said. In the fall of 2008, he was a visiting professor of creative writing at the University of Cape Coast, Ghana. He is also the co-founder of the Ghana Poetry Project, which was formed to promote literary culture and to publish books of poetry in Ghana. In the fall of 2011, his picture biography of DJ Kool Herc, the founder of hip-hop, will be published by Roaring Brook Press. He also wrote A Brush with Napoleon, which was published by Watson Guptill in 2007. And his young adult novel, Casa Azul, was based on the Frida Kahlo painting Self-Portrait with Monkey and Hummingbird, and it was selected as a New York Public Library 2006 book for the teen age. His poems have been included in the Contemporary Poetry of New England Anthology and in numerous literary magazines, including Tar River Review and Denver Quarterly. He was one of the founding editors of American Letters and Commentary. His reader's companion to Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections appeared in print in 2003 from Spark Notes. He has also written critical biographies for Scribner's American Writers and British Writers series on J.M. Coetzee, Bobby Ann Mason, and Jane Kenyon. I spoke to Laban Carrick-Hill last week, and I have to say, unfortunately, although the first half of our conversation recorded very well, a technical glitch in the recording equipment caused something to happen, and so I have to tell you that the second half of the interview is not quite as stellar in quality as the first half. It's audible, but you'll notice the difference, and I do apologize both to you and to Laban Carrick-Hill for the problem. I am, however, going to go ahead and include most of our talk because he's a very interesting guy, and it is audible, and I hope you'll be able to enjoy it in any case. And I also hope that Laban will allow me to invite him back to the show down the road when he publishes his next book. When I spoke to him, I began by commenting that he seems to be a writer who wants to make a real contribution, and I asked him to talk about the roots of that desire.
I grew up with a real sense of service from my mother. She was always involved in, you know, Habitat for Humanity when it first started, and all these. And in her retirement, she's gone around the world and worked holding AIDS babies and working in orphanages in South India and teaching English to Chinese children in northern China.
Wow.
And working with, you know, working on Cook Island, teaching children, and all sorts of things like that.
Where are you from?
I'm really from all over the country. I mean, at core, my family's from Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't born in Memphis. I was born in New York, the only one in the family who was. And we lived up north until I was around 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved back to Memphis. Or my parents divorced, and my mom and my sister and I, we moved back to Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and then by the time I was 17, I moved to New York to become a punk rocker.
Mm-hmm.
And between that, from about 11 to 17, I graduated from high school a year early. I went to 6 different schools. We were poor, living in an apartment on food stamps. My mom was working as a teller at a bank. And I got thrown out of a couple schools and arrested and a bunch of stuff like that. You know, so a lot of transgressing. And then I moved in, then I left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting how many times I've spoken with a writer and found out that they changed schools a lot.
Huh.
And whether or not that had something to do with becoming a writer, it does seem like people find solace and company in writing.
Yeah.
Particularly maybe if it was hard to make friends because you were on the move a lot or something like that.
Well, it's sort of an odd thing that I became a writer because I have ADHD and I didn't really learn to write till in fifth grade read.
Oh, wow.
And I gave the same book report from first through fifth grade on Harold and the Purple Crayon.
Oh, it's a great book.
It's a great book, Making Your World. And so it wasn't really until I was 10 or 11 that I really began to be able to decode the page. I was also dyslexic as well.
Right.
Uh-huh. So it was always very hard to read.
So what an interesting choice of career. How did you become a writer then?
You know, I think I tend to do the things I can't do.
Uh-huh.
You know, that are the hardest.
Do you still find writing to be a great challenge?
Oh, yeah.
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 Huh. I was going to ask you also about your name.
Well, Laban Carrick Hill, the first name Laban comes from the Old Testament, and he was Jacob's father-in-law. The short version is he cheated Jacob, and Jacob prayed to God, and God smote Laban. Laban was not a particularly nice guy.
Hmm.
And my middle name is Gaelic and Scotch, Celtic. And it means Rocky Crag.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very common name in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Lord Mountbatten was the Earl of Carrick, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of part of my family. And then there's Hill, and somehow I think Hill is a translation of Carrick.
Okay.
And so the name Carrick came from both sides of my family. My mother's maiden name was Carrick, and my father's first name is Carrick. And it just happened. They're not related. Not even close.
That's interesting. But if it's a common name and they have a common, sort of background.
Yeah. So it just ended up that these were family names. Laban. My grandfather was named Laban. Cousin named Laban. I've never met anybody who is not related to me that's named Laban.
Yeah. Huh. Well, it just is an interesting name, so I wondered about it. So you have written, you said, 36 books at this point.
Around 36, yeah. I don't really know exactly.
So how did you begin writing for young readers?
It was purely by accident. I was a poet, and went to graduate school at Columbia for poetry. I got a job in publishing, and I saw an opportunity. I was writing jacket covers and press releases and advertisements for a publishing house, and I saw an opportunity to make a little money. And so I put in a proposal. My wife is a graphic designer, and she has very great, very terrific graphic drawing skills. She doesn't like to say that she's an illustrator because she doesn't do it. But we put in a proposal under a pseudonym for a book called Monster Dots, a dot-to-dot book on monsters.
Okay.
And that paid for our first daughter's birth. Because we didn't have any money to pay the hospital bill, so that book is actually still in print, and you know, it's 20 years later, it's still in print, and we still get royalty checks from it. Not very big, but you know, a few dollars here and there every.
That's interesting.
Every few months, and you know, and then I had a friend who was in the children's department at Bantam, where I was working at the time, and they were doing a series of mystery novels based on the TV series Ghost Rider. It's a children's television series.
I remember that, yeah.
And she asked me if I wanted to write one of the books, and I said, sure, why not? And then it just sort of stumbled upon some more other things. I wrote some Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Oh, yeah.
And Choose Your Own Nightmare books, you know. And then I came up with my own series called Extreme Sports, and it was about a group of kids who loved to snowboard and mountain bike and do all sorts of extreme sports, and were always solving mysteries. And that went for a few years.
Were these books largely published at the same publishing house?
No. The Extreme Mystery books were published by Hyperion.
Okay.
And the other books were published by Bantam. But to backtrack a little bit, is when I was writing the book for the Ghostwriter series, I came up with the idea for Harlem Stomp. Actually, what I was doing, I was reading a biography on a Harlem Renaissance poet named County Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, God, this would be a great, I would love to write a biography of this for young adults. And, you know, because one, he became famous when he was about 17 or 18 for his poetry. And two, he quit writing when he was 33 and taught French at a high school in Harlem where James Baldwin and Toni Morrison were his students. And three, there's this great story of where he marries W.E.B. Du Bois' daughter as an agreement because Du Bois owed County Cullen a significant amount of money. And so Cullen marries Du Bois' daughter, and as they're leaving on their honeymoon to Europe, County Cullen leaves her on the dock and takes his male lover instead. And so the marriage didn't last. But, you know, I knew that, you know, in 1993, it wouldn't, you know, I could never sell that. But I thought, well, if I could possibly establish a marketplace for it by talking about the whole era, maybe then I could do, you know, runoff books. So I came up with this idea for the Harlem Renaissance and tried to sell it. And nobody would buy it.
Wow.
Nobody was interested. Nobody wanted it. I think one is African American history wasn't seen as a viable marketplace, and two, even if it were a viable marketplace, they didn't feel comfortable with someone white writing about African American history. And so I put it on the shelf.
And that was what year?
It was about 93.
Okay.
And I put it on the shelf, and then I was broke around 2000. And so I just started pulling everything off the shelf, and I had a new agent, and I just started showing her anything and everything, and she looked at it and she said, oh, I could sell this in a second. And she sold it in a week.
Wow.
So times change, you know, and attitudes change.
Yeah. Well, I had a question for you about Harlem Stomp, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. Mm-hmm. This is a description of the book from the Booklist review. With a beautiful open design, this illustrated history combines the politics of the black metropolis in the roaring 1920s with long detailed chapters on the blazing creativity of performers, writers, visual artists, and intellectuals. Many readers will dip into pages that interest them. Others will appreciate the big picture, including the facts about the great migration from the South, the continuing racism, the debate concerning how blacks should win equal rights, and the call to get beyond sentimentality and propaganda. It's a wonderful review. It was a wonderful book. It's beautiful, and I love the mix of photographs and drawings and explanations, and there are insets with relevant stories. So I wondered how you decided to structure the book. It reminded me a little bit of a scrapbook. You know, it was just constantly fascinating to turn the page.
Well, my intention all along from the early days was to make it magazine-like more, mm-hmm. and visually dynamic and more representative of the Jazz Age and the Harlem Renaissance, which isn't simply swaths of text. The great book, the great history on Harlem, was a book written in 1972 called When Harlem Was in Vogue. And that book is an academic book with swaths of text. And the other thing that I noticed was that at that time, that book was written to make the case for the viability of the Harlem Renaissance being a legitimate area of study and reading. By 2000, that case didn't need to be made anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, that was 30 years later. That case had already been internalized in popular culture. And so now, what I had to do was instead of, the way I thought about it, was I had to get out of the way of the story. Whereas he would take... What this author would do was he would take something to me that looked incredibly obvious, and then he would explicate it. Mm-hmm. He would have all this intellectual apparatus surrounding it. And I felt like it was unnecessary. And so what I tried to do was give a spirit of the era and the dynamism of the era on each spread. So when I wrote this book, I wrote it spread by spread. Mm-hmm. And I did all the picture research myself, and there are 130 pictures in this book. I had around 300 that could have been in the book when I was doing the research. And I was fortunate enough that I had a magazine designer who was my wife design book. And she's been a designer at Sports Illustrated and at Eating Well and, you know, And now she's at UVM, and so she has a real understanding of to have a dynamic page the way you do in a magazine versus the way it's done in a typical picture book or a picture coffee table book.
Well, that's interesting because you said a little while ago that she's not an illustrator. She doesn't want to be pegged as an illustrator. Yeah. So I thought, oh, so she hasn't worked on your books. But in fact, she's been very useful, very helpful.
She's designed two of the books, the American Dreaming. And, and both of those are, you know, both of those are where the visual narrative and the visual content is as important as the textual content.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that I love, just to give an example of the sort of thing that you include that's just constantly new, interesting information, you included a glossary of Harlem jive from A Harlem Renaissance, a historical dictionary for the era. And it was really interesting because some of the terms are within, you know, our purview. We understand, you know, that hot means, you know, well, it means attractive now, but I think in your book it was wonderful and exceptional, hot. And to bring mud is to disappoint, and a frail eel is a pretty girl. Yeah. So I was wondering, do you know how many of those terms are still used perhaps within the African-American community, or specifically maybe geographically in Harlem, that we maybe don't hear all the time in sort of American culture across the whole country? Do you know anything about that?
You know, language is incredibly dynamic, mm-hmm. and constantly changing. And so I doubt that anything that from this dictionary, at least, that isn't being used by the wider American population is probably not being used by the subculture, unless it's being used, revitalized for, an ironic sense. I mean, like the word dude, in the 1990s, that got revitalized again in a very kind of ironic sense. And now, somebody my age at 51, uses the word dude, or says, I'm down with that, or something like that. And so that shows you, how these things kind of spread out very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And aren't really, and so, subgroups are constantly both pulling, phrases, old phrases, and revitalizing them, and also coming up with new ones. And I don't know if I could ever tell you, exactly what, what phrase is hip in African American culture, or in Asian culture, mm-hmm. Or in suburban white boy culture.
Mm-hmm. Right. And by age too, it's going to be something that you may or may not know about.
Is that it's also heavily influenced by African American culture, and I think that Ralph Ellison has a phrase as a statement that he wrote maybe 60 years ago, that no matter whoever the true American is also somehow black,
mm.
and that at our core, when we go to look at ourselves and we go to really examine who we are and our identity, we will find some degree of blackness there. Our culture, so much of our culture is defined and influenced by black culture.
Mm-hmm.
For music, there wouldn't be any rock and roll, there wouldn't be any hip hop, there wouldn't be any blues, there wouldn't be any, a lot of church music now, all of this gospel music, it's all deeply influenced. And even classical music, is influenced by African American culture, and it goes across the board, to style and clothing, and
in a way, the profound racist is certainly building a belief system around a reaction to blacks, a reaction to African Americans.
I once gave a talk at a high school in northern Wisconsin, and afterwards, about a dozen skinheads came up to me and said how much they hate black people. And as I was looking at them, I started talking to them. I started decoding and asking them questions, decoding them, because they were so deeply influenced by black culture. I mean, they were wearing the prison-style pants with them really low-hung. They were wearing the kind of T-shirts, the kind of, bandana, the Nike Michael Jordan shoes. They liked rock. I explained to them that everything that they care and love about comes from black culture.
And what did they say?
They were just sort of stunned and in silence, uh-huh. They didn't know what to make of it.
That's interesting.
I didn't try to convince them that they were wrong. Instead, I just looked at how they represented themselves and how deeply African-American their representation was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned a minute ago American Dreaming, how youth changed America in the 60s. When I was looking at this book, I found myself wondering what was going on politically in this country when you decided to write this book, and if the political climate of the time prompted you to write about the 60s.
Well, I actually wrote another book, a novel, that was influenced by the political climate. It was called A Brush with Napoleon. And it's about a young boy, or 17-year-old, who's plucked out of Napoleon's army in 1801 to sit for a portrait as Napoleon for the French painter David. And this is the famous painting of Napoleon crossing the Alps on a white steed that's rearing. And this is one of the kind of clear, and you know, one of the, this is a famous kind of propaganda story, is that it was the painting was initially commissioned by Napoleon's brother, who was the king of Spain. Napoleon heard about it and asked that David paint three more, because he wanted to show it around the country. And this was also the first painting that David painted without the person he was supposed to paint sitting for the portrait. And Napoleon said, "You're not painting me, you're painting Napoleon for the ages, so I don't need to sit for it."
So even the original he didn't sit for.
No. And so so someone else sat for it. And so this is the person, so this story is from the perspective of the person who sat for this portrait. And what Napoleon wanted to do was use this use these paintings for propaganda, to sell the war, to sell his conquering. You know, he represents France, who's going to conquer all of Europe. And so, you know, this was, I wrote this in, 2003, 2004. You know, as the time that Bush and his propaganda machine was selling, you know, the Iraq War and the lies that they were telling. And so this was my way of kind of explaining how dangerous propaganda is through this boy's eyes, his innocence eyes. But this book, what I was more concerned with is what I think about it is I think a lot about identity, about who I am, and where I place myself in the world, and the arc of American culture, American identity, and who we all are. And what interests me is these moments in history where our identity shifts or changes in some way. And with the Harlem Renaissance, what happened there was this deep, significant, kind of seismic shift in American understanding of itself from an understanding of Black culture, from Black culture being unconscious acknowledged to Black culture being acknowledged and celebrated. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed about the 60s is that, you know, I kept thinking about the legacy of the 60s, what is the real legacy of the 60s, and why should we care? And why should someone who's 20 years old care? Or why should someone who's 16 years old care? And what does it mean to them? And because it really changed our culture again. But changed our culture in a way, and this is what I'm interested in, these shifts that are that have nothing to do with war. Mm-hmm. It's like World War II changed our culture dramatically. Civil War changed our culture dramatically. World War I changed our culture. Vietnam War changed our culture. I'm not so interested in the influences of the wars as I am in the more cultural aspects. I mean, certainly there, you know, you can make a case that the Harlem Renaissance couldn't have happened without World War I.
Right.
And the 60s couldn't have happened without the Vietnam War. You can make some of those cases, less so, I think, for the 60s. But I think that what I'm interested in is the sort of non-military, non-war aspects, because the war aspect, people have covered it really well.
Right.
And I don't have anything to add to it.
Well, even without covering war, you cover so much ground. You talk about the baby boomers, civil rights, and this, you know, sort of encompasses African Americans, Native Americans, Latinos. You talked about women's rights, and you talked about environmentalism. I was wondering if you ended up having to leave anything out that you wanted to include simply because of how much the book was covering, or did
the
scope...
What I would have loved to cover more on, and it was a really, really painful decision that hurt a friend of mine as well, is I would have loved to have had a separate chapter on gay and lesbian culture. Mm-hmm. The decision I made is because really kind of gay consciousness and gay consciousness didn't really begin full stride until the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of a, where do I cut off? And and there was a lot of gay consciousness raising going on in the 60s, but it was very small
compared to everything else that was going on.
Yeah, but one of the things I really felt about this story was that the story of the 60s for me is not about the Vietnam War. It's about the rise of multiculturalism. Mm-hmm. Now, if Ralph Ellison were alive, he would perhaps revise his statement from whatever the true American is, she is also somehow Black, Latina, Asian, mm-hmm. Native American. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about your most recent book, Dave the Potter. It's about an actual figure from history.
Correct.
And he was a slave who made clay pots. And he this was a fascinating story. He occasionally would inscribe poems on his pots and sign them with his name, Dave. So how did you hear about him?
I went to a conference at St. Mike's. A friend of mine, Laurie Smith, was running on the slave trade. And I went to a talk about the influence of African art on African-American art. And as the speaker was going through slides, a slide of a pot came up with a poem written on the side of it. And this poem really kind of stunned me. I mean, the pot was only on there for maybe, 60 seconds. And I wrote the poem down, and the poem was a poem that resonated with me. It was, I made this jar all of cross. If you don't repent, you will be lost. And I had never heard of this guy, Dave, who she talked about for a minute. And so I wrote him down, and I just let it sit with me. And over several months, I started doing a little research on him. There weren't any books on him. And I really felt like this would be something I wanted to write about. And I didn't know quite how to do it. And I thought, well, it could be a picture book. It could not. I started to write a poem. I wrote a number of drafts of the poem. Most of them were absolutely horrible because I had to work my way through the sort of apparatus of because the first thing you think of when you think of him writing poems at a time when it was a death sentence to know how to read and write, all you want to do is talk about that and his courage, mm-hmm. and that's the kind of story that's been told once. And so I had to strip away all that sort of stuff and just get to the pot. And once I got to the pot and just focused on him making this pot and all the other information about him and surrounding him, people automatically know.
Mm-hmm. How much were you able to find out about him when you started researching him?
Well, there wasn't much at all. He was mentioned a number of times in the local newspaper, in very small ways, like in a paragraph or a sentence, over the years, because one of his owners at one time owned the local newspaper. Mm-hmm. He was mentioned in wills and in bills of sales, mm-hmm. Because he's property. Mm-hmm. And that's about it.
Okay. So the person who owned the newspaper and he was mentioned in the newspaper, were they writing about their slave who made pots?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes it was about, mentioning that he, made something and at one point he got drunk and fell asleep on the railroad tracks and the train ran over his leg and he lost it.
Okay. Right.
And so that was mentioned in the
It's mentioned in the author's note at the end of the book, isn't it?
I think so.
You didn't include that as part of the actual story.
No, it was just one too many details because we're talking 500 words.
I was going to ask you if you wanted to read a couple pages from Dave the Potter.
Oh, that would be a pleasure. To us, it is just dirt, the ground we walk on. Scoop up a handful, the greedy grains slip between your fingers. On wet days, heavy with rainwater, It is cool and squishy, mud pie heaven. But to Dave, it was clay, the plain and basic stuff upon which he learned to form a life as a slave nearly 200 years ago. To us, it is just a pot, round and tall, good for keeping marbles or fresh-cut flowers. But to Dave, it was a pot large enough to store a season's grain harvest, to put up salted meat, to hold memories. Each one began out of a cloud of dust, clotted clumps of clay, ground in the pug mill and carried wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow to Dave's spinning potter's wheel. With a flat wooden paddle, large enough to row across the Atlantic, Dave mixed clay with water drawn from the Big Horse Creek until wet and stiff and heavy. He threw clay, sometimes 60 pounds at once, and nobody knew how or where it would land except Dave.
Thank you very much. It is a it's a poem as well as a picture book. I forgot to mention that earlier, that the entire book is a poem. So did you try at all to put it into the style of Dave's sort of simple poetry that he put on the sides of his pots? Were you trying to emulate a little bit of his voice?
Well, during some drafts I did. And I also ended up writing at one point the poem in couplets. And it was just god-awful. It was just... Oh, it was embarrassing, really bad. Really what I wanted to do was, there are moments of figuration in this poem of mine, you know, when I talk about him rowing across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and that was wonderful.
And moments like that, or the robin's red breast puffed up as the bowl of the pot rises. Mainly what I try to do is kind of just tell the story, you know, and just try to be in the comparison between, you know, the other thing was to anchor kids in who he was and how he was different than they are. To us it's just mud by heaven, but to him it was something that really had deep meaning and it's in a real sense of powerful expression. And, you know, and the irony, the subtlety of that for me is that, you know, that's the irony of so many things in this life is, you know, what is meaningless or trite to us, to me, can be something quite life-changing to someone else. And I don't mean that in a sort of superficial way, you know, because, you know, we could say that, you know, everybody is special, you know, but I mean it more in a way that someone can take something that's seemingly trite and bring depth and meaning to it that has a density that we could never imagine.
Mm-hmm. What I loved about the book is that you used specific detail and just experiences of his life to show us what the moment was like of building these pots, and that made him so much more real, I thought, than just sort of being lectured at about what, you know, what it must have been like back then, you know. And the drawings are absolutely beautiful. I did want to mention those as well, the paintings, I guess they are.
Well, I'm going to take two of those covers. Those are two separate comments. But the first one, I had to work my way through all of that because one of the things that, as you know, this late in our age, 2011, the narrative of the victimization of African Americans in the broader American culture has been covered incredibly well. You know, there's phenomenal, great books about it. There's nothing I can add to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing that I feel I should add And with America's kind of long history, white America's long history of appropriating African American culture, I felt in many ways that it was deeply problematic if I was going to sit. And that goes with the Harlem Renaissance book as well. It's not a story of victimization. It's, you know, deeply problematic if I'm going to appropriate their victimization.
Mm-hmm. As a white writer.
As a white writer.
Right.
And I'm always, you know, and that's something I'm very conscious of. And many times, I mean, one of the ironies is that many times I go and speak and everybody expects me to be black. Mm-hmm. When I went down to the National Book Awards, they kind of looked at me and they go, but you're white. And so often what I do is the first thing I say when I go to speak is, some of you might not have noticed, but I'm white. And what's a white guy talking about African American culture? And I deal with that issue right off. But with Dave, you know, since that story of victimization has been covered so exquisitely well, mm-hmm. and I can't add anything to it. So what I needed to do was find something that I could say that would broaden our understanding without repeating. And the thing that really does that is Dave's remarkable art. You know, in spite of what he faced.
Right, right.
And so my feeling is I wanted to get out of the way. Now, in also writing it, and this comes down to the illustrations. You know, part of my job as a writer is to provide language and narrative and image that the illustrator can respond to, mm-hmm. and can work with and expand on. Mm-hmm. You know, a good illustrator doesn't just show exactly what the words say, but instead brings it out and expands it. You know, I mean, one of the great moments of that is... it's the tree. You know, this illustration,
yes.
There's an illustration here where Dave is standing outside and his arms are spread out like he's about to embrace the world. And behind him is a tree, and on the limbs of the tree are the images of African American history. And so next to this, my text was, the jar grew so large Dave could no longer wrap his strong arms around it. If he climbed into the jar and curled into a ball, he would have been embraced. Now, Brian Collier could have done an illustration of Dave curled up in the jar, and that would be the most logical one. But instead, we have him out in the field with his arms out, ready to embrace the world. And behind him is the tree of African American culture.
Right. His history is embracing him in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. His history is embracing him. So that sense of genius on his part is just wonderful.
Had you worked with him before you wrote this book?
I had not. I had desperately wanted him to illustrate this book.
Oh.
And so, but he had turned us down at first because he was too busy. And one of the reasons he was so busy is that when he takes a book on, he really digs into it. So he doesn't just, you know, do a book. So he turned it down because he didn't feel he had the time to do it justice. And then he had some time, and so he came back and said he could do it. You know, and he went down to South Carolina and interviewed people and looked at pots, mm-hmm. and looked at the ground where Dave worked and all of this.
Wow, that's...
I mean, he did immense research on it.
That's wonderful. So obviously you're very interested in African American culture and African culture. Another project that you've been involved with is you're the co-founder of an organization called the Writers Project of Ghana.
Yes.
Whose mission is to promote a literary culture in Africa and around the world. So how did that come about?
Well, I went to, I was invited to teach at the University of Cape Coast in Ghana to start a creative writing program. And one of the things that that in the third world in general, when you want to get something done, things don't get done at a particularly fast pace, and you've got to get a lot of buy-in from people who aren't necessarily see that change is really going to help them establish, because there's always the fear of loss of power and what they have, which is very limited. So when I went to Ghana, I ended up doing nothing for various political reasons at the university. And so I started reaching out to writers around the country and started doing meetups and having readings and doing things like that. And one person I met was a physicist at the University of Ghana in Accra named Martin Egwuegbe, and marvelous poet and fiction writer. And he and I started having these readings, and 60 people would show up, 40 people would show up. And it went really, really well. And so we decided that as we looked around, there was no real organization nurturing young writers. There were also no books being published. And so we decided to do an anthology of New Ghanaian poets titled Look Where You Have Gone to Sit, which is an Akan proverb. Is the title of it, and it just came out 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. And we started that, and then we realized as we were editing this anthology that it was going to be a one-off. That, okay, we do the anthology, it'd be great, but it's not going to really start anything. So we decided to start an organization that would have readings, that would promote writers, that would have writing workshops, which there weren't any in Ghana at the mm-hmm. time, mm-hmm. And all sorts of things like that, and to also bring different writers and writers groups together and to help support and do this. And so we started building this organization, and we were running it on a shoestring for about a year and a half. And then last spring, I went to Ghana for 2 months, and we got the U.S. State Department to fund us. And so we have an office now, and we have all sorts of, many of the same things that we were doing, but we also have clubs, writing clubs in high schools, and we have, and we partnered with an organization called World Reader, which gives Kindles to high school kids, loaded with about 100 books on them, and we work with the kids to read and to, and make sure that the Kindles don't just sit there and lay there and don't do anything or get sold, because the price of a Kindle is about the price of maybe 3-4 months of their parents' salary. Mm-hmm. So you have to really be on top of that. So we're run all by volunteers. We've got about 40 or 50 volunteers and two staff members that are paid. And it's been, extremely successful.
Is it to support specifically the local writing community, or do you encourage involvement from other international communities to come in and participate, for example, in the workshops or anything like that?
We do. This summer we have last year we had an intern, a Jamaican intern, working with us who was a student at Duke. And this year we've got two interns, and we've got a professor of creative writing from the University of Ohio working with us this summer. Mm-hmm. And we're, looks like next year we might have some Fulbrights working with us. So, we do, we've had some Nigerians participate, mm-hmm. and we've had writers from around the world participate. Mm-hmm.
Do you work, do you fundraise? Do you do some of that work? Or?
We don't do a lot of fundraising right now because we're funded pretty well.
You found it, okay.
Yeah.
That's great. What are some of your favorite books for adults and for young readers?
You know, I was a judge last year for the National Book Awards, so I had to read 230 novels.
Oh my gosh.
And that were published last year, 230 books. And
what category?
The young adult.
So young adult
literature.
So novels. You were reading full novels.
Novels and some nonfiction. Yeah.
Okay.
And the one that won was a book called Mockingbird. It's gorgeous. It's an absolutely wonderful book. There's another one called One Crazy Summer that is really great. Now, I also have really commercial tastes, and but I think that these books are really beautifully written. Or the Harry Potter series.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can't beat it. And also, reading her series, watching her become a better writer as she grows a writer as the series comes along is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
But that series is just brilliantly done. It's wonderful, and it's something that you can read and reread. I just finished a book that is sort of a young adult steampunk novel called 9-Pound Hammer. And I really enjoyed that.
What is a steampunk novel?
Steampunk is science fiction based on Victorian era science.
Oh, okay. That's new to me.
So it's got to, things that could be propelled by steam and things like that.
Okay.
As opposed to, in order to, fly to Mars.
Right. So some of the things that have been done with H.G. Wells, would that fit in there? You know, how some of that stuff's been turned even more science fiction than his original ideas.
Yeah, there's a whole big genre now.
Yeah, okay.
Steampunk.
I didn't know it was called steampunk. Well, Laban, I want to thank you very much for talking with me. This was a great pleasure.
It was really an honor. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Laban Carrick Hill. And just reiterate that I do apologize that some of that interview had some poor quality to the recording. I don't know exactly what happened to the equipment, but hopefully you were able to enjoy it. He's a really interesting guy. To learn more about the work of Laban Carrick Hill, check out his website. Laban is spelled L-A-B-A-N, Hill, H-I-L-L, .com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Laban Carrick Hill. He describes it as an exercise about transgression. Try to write a children's picture book from the point of view of a young boy whose brother was tortured and murdered during rendition at Guantanamo. Laban Carrick Hill explains that this might be the least likely book that would ever be written, and that is why he feels it makes a good prompt. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows. Sometimes, occasionally, I put them on my blog, which is very lonely because I don't get there very often. writethebook.wordpress.com. A reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, you can send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter, at writethebook, all one word. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. We're going to put some great music on for a little while, and then some more great music will be on when Cheryl gets here. She's going to be a tiny bit late this afternoon. She'll be here with the World of Music at around 3:15. So hang in there. She'll be in. And in the meantime, we're going to just put some music on from the Vermont Music Library. This has been Write the Book. I am Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.